Okay, this is the ACTA panel. The anti-counterfeiting, counterfeiting trade agreement. The draft version, an update from last year. I'm sitting in the middle, but I'm not in charge, but I'm Chris Huffines. I am an attorney from Casey Gilson here in Atlanta. I'm a trial attorney. Yes, ma'am. I can hear the echo, so it's turned on. Okay, my name is Chris Huffines. I'm a trial attorney from Atlanta, Georgia, from the firm of Casey Gilson, and I'm in the middle, but I'm not in charge. Next.
You were talking first, so now you're in charge.
Oh. Courtney will introduce herself next.
I'm Courtney Perry. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta also, but primarily in academics. I teach at Emory Law School as an adjunct, and if I look a little strung out today, it's because I just handed in the manuscript for a textbook. So I have a few brain cells left clicking around. By my general copyright panel tomorrow, I promise I'll have had some sleep. But today we're talking about ACTA, and that's interesting since we have an update from last year. I do a lot of intellectual property work, some small business work, and like I said, right now I'm kind of shuffling over towards the academic side, so we have a kind of a balance of opinions, plus I've always done transactional work. I think trial lawyers are evil. Except for Christopher, who's lovely.
Okay.
Well, on that note, my name's Cara Mikus. I'm a litigation specialist. So, sorry. I'm based in Denver. So, yes, also strung out from travel and somewhat lack of sleep. But I'll do my best, certainly, to answer any questions and fill in where I can for you guys.
And since
argue also.
Yeah, this is the argument table, and this is the solutions table. Last year, we didn't have, Courtney and I did a panel on ACTA last year, and we had essentially no information at all, except for a couple of leaks that I think turned out to be reasonably
sort of online,
on point.
But
yeah. So this year, we actually have a rough draft treaty that the EFF has put out. So I guess we'll just start talking about that. The first thing that struck me about this is that it's a couple of countries, it's about 8 or 9 or 10, who are kind of going behind the World Trade Organization's back and kind of going around what's called the TRIPS Treaty, which is the current international copyright regime, to set up something different and a lot more like the DMCA. What do y'all think?
I think that to an extent that's true. I think that what was perceived was not really technically an intention to steal all of your rights from you. I don't think that that was what was motivating these countries. What they're trying to find a way to do is more effectively battle counterfeiting, which has been obviously a huge international issue, and individual national laws are having very little help, are not being effective sufficiently. In theory, if counterfeit goods are imported into this country, you have trademark laws and other things that allow you to sort of confiscate those. But what the rights holders, from their perspective, what they have been finding, and you have to take a step back and not immediately hiss when you think about the motion picture industry. what they have found is that, you know, obviously walk down the street in, ironically, Korea, since that they're now involved in this negotiation, or any of the pirating countries. And even more so than walking down the streets of New York, you find all of the pirated movies openly sold in stores, if not on the streets. And individual countries say, oh no, we enforce our piracy laws once in a while on a guy who didn't pay off the local officials. But the motion picture companies have discovered that was bad enough before. Now that it's all online, you have, I mean, Pirate Bay and folks like that who come out and say, well, instead of just selling counterfeited movies on the streets of Singapore, where most Americans don't get, now we can get them to everyone's home easily and quickly. And so the rights holders are just panicking. And this is one of the things that they and our country, as a more of an approach of we need to find a way to meaningful enforce our laws and have some protection that we have deemed in our current copyright schemes and trademark schemes should be affected. It's not working without some international cooperation. And that's what drove this. I mean, it did kind of, they needed to take it outside of TRIPS because that wasn't working well enough. And they started with a kind of hand-chosen group of countries who was willing to say that piracy is bad as opposed to countries who make some significant income off of taxing folks who are just blatantly violating copyrights from developed countries. And so it was not done as an evil intended act. Now, the impact it may have is something that a lot of folks, especially you guys, tend to be concerned by. And I don't think the concerns are unfounded, but it's not evil or bad or sneaky on its face. I'm the contrarian on the panel, by the way.
She is. Okay, so let's jump up. How many of you out there have an iPod? All right, how many have a cell phone? How many of you did any type of research regarding this entire con online? All right. Well, guess what? ACTA is enabled. Your rights to do any of that, anytime you decide to cross a border, every one of those things is now subject to the guys at border crossings and what are they technically called?
Homeland Security.
Yeah, those mean guys. Your laptops are now subject to searches. So while ACTA is designed, in theory, not to be evil, to protect the right holders, but your laptops are now subject to searches every time you cross a border. They open it up, they flip through it, oh my gosh, you downloaded something from Pirate Bay. Guess what? Your laptop is now subject to be destroyed at your cost, and the right holder, for whatever movie, gets to decide how much you actually damaged him by owning his pirated goods. That's what ACTA is going to do. Your personal rights are going to be infringed upon hugely. Sorry, told you I was going to argue.
That's fine.
Well, this is a litigation table over here, so I'll take the adversarial view, which is that's largely true. I think it's a little bit overstated in that border security already could check your laptop. They really felt like
that's the big thing. Every time you walk through an American airport, they can do that. And if you're crossing into a foreign country, your American rights don't follow you. You are now subject to their rights. And for all that we like to talk about how we are oppressed by our government, boy, you should look at what your personal rights under pretty much any other country's laws are.
My dad has a funny story about traveling to Saudi Arabia, the punchline of which is he had taken a blank zip disk with him. And the first thing he knows is customs in Saudi Arabia had taken the zip disk and his passport and walked out the back door to check it for him in case he was smuggling in, you know, whatever, trade secrets or a Bible or whatever they decided wasn't acceptable.
Yeah.
And the second thing is the seizure equipment and the decision of damages is a little bit more subtle than that. And I think it's still horrible, but it's just not quite as in that it's for equipment that's predominantly used for infringement. So, you know, if my laptop's used 60% for work, 20% for email, and 20% for pirating music, probably okay. If my home...
Is that an admission? Wait.
I don't even have a laptop.
This is hypothetical.
You know, if my home server is used 80% for internet work, most of which is piracy, and 20% for storing pictures and, you know, whatever, so all of a sudden, yes, I get to pay for the privilege of having my home server destroyed by the government for something that, you know, or maybe if my kid was doing a whole bunch of file sharing, the parent's server is all of a sudden at risk.
Now, that's always the case, too. The parent's always liable for the illegal activities of their child.
Man, my parents are in trouble.
My kid's six. I'm not in a lot of trouble yet.
But the interesting thing that Cara mentioned was the right holder allowing to set the level of damages. And the treaty has a specific provision saying, essentially, the rights holder gets to suggest what the damages should be. And then you get to argue about it. And any of you who understand the psychology of this realize that it's an enormous advantage to say, well, here's where we're going to start our argument, way up here, and you can try to argue me down to something reasonable, but you know, you'll meet in the middle somewhere unreasonable. So that's a huge advantage to the rights holder.
Now, how does that differ in your view from how you would normally do that in a civil trial anyway? Now, this is not necessarily a straight civil trial, but in a civil trial, if you're the plaintiff, you're going to get to ask for the damages you want anyway. So you have that same anchoring effect of the negotiation bargaining zone.
Well, there is a rule. I mean, okay, lawyers speak. There's a Rule 11 obligation, which is a rule of the federal rules, requires lawyers to have ethics. Thank you. And to
ethics is a term of art. It doesn't mean what you think it means. We define it ourselves,
which is very helpful. And but any pleading I sign in federal court and state court under Charter Rule 11 must have a good faith basis for the contents. So I can't say, you ran over my cat who had cancer, is going to die tomorrow, you owe me $20 million. That cat ain't worth $20 million, nor close. So I just violated Rule 11 had I done that.
I haven't noticed that slowing down plaintiff's bar.
The plaintiff's bar is extremely aggressive and very interested in pushing the boundaries. And I think it would be far, far worse. I do also think there is a practical limit that in federal court and state court, but especially in federal court, you do not honk off the judge. He will make your life miserable, or she. An attorney, especially a plaintiff's attorney that's playing games like that, will get on the wrong side of the judge. I have a case I'm thinking of right now where I was one of the attorneys where we were obviously winning. We were obviously probably going to win. And the judge made rulings in such a way as to minimize the ability of the other party to appeal. So there was a close call that wouldn't affect the outcome. He ruled for them. That way they couldn't appeal it. It was purely a, you're playing straight with me. I'm gonna be nice to you. You're not playing straight with me. I'm not going to be nearly as nice. Nothing improper, but it certainly was. You do not honk off the judge. So I think there's that practical level. There's also just, we were talking earlier about the media company, this is the previous panel, that has begun suing bloggers especially who are linking to content that they own from newspapers that they bought that content or the rights to that content. At some point that lawyer is going to get taken up before his own bar for discipline. And I think eventually that's going to happen on these situations where if somebody does just abuse the system, they're going to get nailed. It's just going to take 10 years.
I have learned not to trust the plaintiff's bar to police itself like that.
I also specialize in plaintiff's personal injury, so I'm going to speak to that really quickly. A lot of times there is a discernible way to define damages. You know, you have to have some type of paperwork to show, okay, well, this is the number. This is where we were, and wait, I actually suffered some emotional damage and I cried a lot, and now we have to come up with a number two. And that's kind of where the gray area sets in.
That's the squishy part, is the emotional damages.
Right.
The actual damages of, you know, my business lost this much money, or I had to replace these pieces of merchandise that cost this much. You broke my car, which has a market value. Those are fairly easy to set. The emotional damages.
In Georgia, it is left, quote, to the enlightened conscience of the jury. Whatever that means.
And in Georgia, we're all scared.
Yeah. Also punitive. That's the same standard, which should scare you immensely. So
the questionable part arises when the damaged party, I'm one of the music trade industry. You stole my song. Hold on. What's it worth now? I could have made $30 million, but you pirated it, and instead of me being able to sell it, never mind that it sucks, but I could have, in theory. So walk up to the judge and say, "No, $30 million. That's, this guy damaged me."
So and in fairness, you're also dealing with the jury. At some point, you're going to have to convince 12 people or 6 people, depending on your jurisdiction, that this actually does make sense.
But no, not under the ACTA treaty, because damages are assigned, and before, and this is another sticky point, you are presumed guilty before your innocence is actually proven, your damages are assigned, your equipment destroyed.
That was one of the second points I wanted to make, and I think this is actually a great transition into it, which is how let's assume the worst possible thing about the ACTA treaty. Let's get it signed, ratified, it's now U.S. law. Now we have judges actually applying it. You know, is it going to survive? Is it just going to get gutted? Kaczynski, to talk about the California case, is he going to just get on a mad and just tear this thing apart out in the Ninth Circuit? You know, I mean, how do we think this is going to get actually applied practically when a judge or a jury actually get a hold of it?
You know, that part is still up in the air as far as I'm.
With respect to like the Berne Convention, which is the existing international copyright act, copyright treaty, basically, the United States was the last of the developed countries to finally sign on to it. It took us a very, very long time, because in order to sign on to the Berne Convention, we had to agree to change our copyright law substantially. The 76 Act, the new 76 Act copyright law was put in effect kind of so we could get there, and then the Byrne the Byrne Implementation Act of, what was it, 81? It was several years after that. They, in order to make the treaty apply on a statutory level, at least normally, now this, we don't know how it's going to go because there is not a final acted text, by the way. We're arguing about what we think it may say and what they, one of the options in here, that for each section there's several different countries wanting several different things. But usually what you would have from the treaty exists, but it exists at a supra statutory level. Congress then has to enact legislation to give effect to the treaty. The Byrne Implementation Act was how we did it for copyright law. We said, okay, the Byrne Convention requires these things, at least this or more, at least this or more. And that's how a lot of the ACTA treaty is currently sort of phrased, is, you know, you have to provide at least these remedies-ish, and then Congress will actually have to enact the laws that implements that treaty into our statutes. And that's what the judges would most likely be interpreting, not the text of the treaty itself. Sometimes that's not quite how it works. That's how in the past it has worked for copyright, at least.
Just to be entirely clear, under the federal, actually in the Constitution, there is the Constitution. It's number one. And then there are treaties by, you know, to the extent they are self-enacting. And then there's statute, and then there's regulations and other stuff. So the Constitution still wins. If, for example, innocent until proven guilty, I don't think we're going to get rid of that necessarily. If it ever actually gets in front of a judge in practice, Right. Obviously it would be different.
Yeah, nothing in here could trump the Constitution. That's not possible under our setup.
Yeah, and the treaty language does include a lot of pursuant to or not to derogate or not to prejudice your current country's laws. So arguably,
it does not look to me like a self-affecting treaty.
Right.
Again, we don't know yet because it hasn't gotten to that level. But from what I read on it, it looks more like a Byrne Convention approach where this, if you agree, then you agree in theory to all these things. Now go change your laws to comply. So the actual treaty itself would not become part of our system.
And Cara has a great point in that, you know, you're at the Canadian-U.S. border and they're looking at your laptop and they say, I think this is piracy. You can let me destroy your laptop, or you can go back to Canada. And you're a U.S. citizen, but those are your options. And if you want to sit there and litigate it for 4 years and spend $100,000, you know, that is your right.
That's fast.
I'm being generous here.
Go back to Canada, ship your laptop back home, then cross the
right.
Well, that exit over.
It would still be subject to customs on the way in, don't forget.
Canada but, being a bad example, however.
Well, yeah,
they're
true.
Not very fond of the ACTA treaty.
Yeah. Email the documents to yourself and then
wipe
your hard drive and come back over.
Which is ironic because if you Google ACTA, you will discover that one of the early hits is the Association of Canadian Travel Agents. So. It's not necessarily relevant to our research, but if we're talking about coming out of Canada, it's pretty
good.
That's
the Illuminati. a practical matter, I think you're going to have a lot of guilty until proven innocent, just in the matter of as you're actually interacting with police functionaries, yeah. Customs, and
which
actual police.
Which is also kind of the status quo. I don't know that it's a good thing, but it is kind of how it works now anyway. If you get pulled over by a policeman and he says, can I look in your trunk? You're allowed to say no.
And then they'll get a warrant and look at it in the impound.
And, you know, if you haven't seen the Busted panel, you go see that and they'll tell you all about the Fourth Amendment rights and those things. But there's a substantial gap in reality between your constitutional rights on a theoretical level and your rights when you've been pulled over on the side of the road and would like to get to where you need to get going and the policeman is certain you have something in your trunk. There's a power differential there which does not work in your favor. And when you're crossing an international border, oh my gosh, much, much, much more so. And to the extent ACTA gives a much more specific, or would if it's enacted in something similar to the current form, will give a lot more specific instruction towards counterfeited goods and towards pirated things on the computer, a lot of that is already possible and it's not generally done. Obviously, the rights holders are trying to get it done more often. That's what some of this is about. But don't delude yourself into thinking that if the border guard takes your computer, that you really have a meaningful right at that moment. You might succeed later in your litigation and discover, see, I was right, but it doesn't bring your computer back or get you back those 10 years of your life.
I mean, that
to that point, the point about the Constitution, you know, Trump and everything, and nothing in here, you know, the Trump, the Constitution is a great point, but, you know, anything, like you're saying, the point of a lot of this, the proposals in the treaty are to enhance these
absolutely
rights.
Yeah, and there's no question that's the intention, and that will be the effect.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
And I think that you have fewer rights already than you think you do. This definitely, though, puts a spotlight on the IP versions.
Right, so.
This definitely will highlight the IP aspect of it as you go across the border. I don't know how intense the customs people are ever going to be about it. They're a little more concerned about terrorism, but you never know.
And you know, there's a huge practical issue in searching every freaking laptop that comes through LaGuardia, say. I mean, that's...
There was a huge practical issue in making everyone take their shoes off.
Right. I mean, yeah, when there's political will, it'll happen regardless of how convenient it is.
Yeah, we can't take shampoo on the airplanes anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can enact anything they want.
I mean, we can certainly sit here and say that oh, you know, there are practical aspects to this, but, you know, how bad can it actually be? Well, any worse than it is right now is bad, you know, so.
In 20 years from now, maybe we'll be able to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the point. In 20 years, it could be very easy to do. Whereas right now it's fairly easy to tell people to take their shoes off because,
yeah.
Okay, turn around, don't fly. Most people are not going to make a big stink about it.
Nice praise for taking off your
thank
shoes.
Thank you. I'm here all week.
You don't have anything to hide.
Yeah.
Yeah, and let me just step back and say one thing there, that we're talking about a reaction to this law because people don't want to get in trouble for having illegal things on their computer.
Not necessarily.
What I consider illegal and what you consider illegal is two different things.
What the government considers illegal is the relevant standard, and what they're saying is if they can, you know, I don't care what's moral and not moral, but if the government says this is illegal, then it is illegal. And if you have illegal goods on your computer, you are breaking the law. You are subject to penalty for that.
But if I have 10 DVDs full of Creative Commons licensed video that the border guard isn't educated enough to realize isn't illegal, you know, and that's destroyed. Yeah, that.
Sorry, you're paying for it.
Yeah, you know, that's, you can say that, but there are many, you know, we're sitting here.
Oh, I can't imagine how a border guard is going to be able to look at a computer and tell what it is. I mean, I have stuff on my computer that I use for teaching my class. I have an absolute fair use right in the very narrow term, not the expanded crap that it is now, but a very absolute narrow statutory fair use right to put that in my computer and to use it in my classroom. And now, how? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I don't want to have to teach copyright law to a border guard. Since I do that for a living, I probably will have a better chance doing it than a lot of other people because I have some built-in credibility, but I'm still going to lose. Yeah. I don't have any delusion that I'm that persuasive.
Yeah, not only are you going to lose, but, you know, unless you get lucky at the border, you know, starting to educate the border guard.
Now, keep in mind that right now they can still, if they were so inclined, they could still search for stuff. They could look for the kiddie porn on your computer. They could find something and claim, I'm pretty sure this is illegal pornography. And it's, you're like, it's a comic book. And they could still do all of this now. If they want to abuse you, they will find a legitimate way to do it.
And
we're all aware of that, but at the same time, there's no reason, when the door is cracked, there's no reason to push it open.
I do wonder how a border guard is ever going to be able to decide what's copyrighted and protected and what's not. Now, if you have a big chunk on your, you know, My Documents, pirated crap from Pirate Bay, I mean, okay, then it might be easier to tell. Anything that's from Pirate Bay, I mean, they named themselves that, come on. Okay, that's making it easy. Now, the video you have somewhere on there, well, is that copyrighted? Who holds the rights? You'll never know, and how will they? That's a very legitimate issue of how can this be enforced.
Well, there's enough stuff out there that no one can tell whether or not it falls under copyright because of all the,
Is it in public? Has it fallen into public domain, or is it still under copyright?
Right.
I mean, half the time, the Library of Congress's Copyright Office can't tell. So a border guard has no way of knowing.
Even if I took all my CDs that are music I purchased, put on my laptop because I don't want to carry 250 CDs around.
Sure.
How's the border guard going to know?
I have no idea. I have no idea how. I mean, now technically it's illegal now. How do they do that? litigators do you know? Because I honestly don't.
All right, couple distressing things, and I'm so sorry, about the act of treaty. The first thing is that they are trying to enact this secretly. These negotiations have been going on since 2006. So, you know, these are things that the public needs to know about. We should have a say in what's going on. Second, and I find this very disturbing, Section 3 of the ACTA Treaty talks about the criminal enforcement and what they're going to allow in this. ACTA is going to enable authorities to be empowered to take action against infringers. Essentially, ACTA gets to create its own police force. So we're not even necessarily talking about the border guards or anything at that point in time. We're talking about ACTA guards. We've moved into a more specialized agency at that point in time, and they're the ones who are ultimately going to get to decide, no, we don't like that, we're destroying it, we're taking your things, because ACTA has enabled it. I haven't actually seen anything in the language of the treaty itself that speaks to how it's going to behave in our judicial system. So I can't address that. But
what I think is going to end up happening is you're going to get some test cases where police officers are going to do what they think they can get away with, or they think they should, or they're going to have best practices from their local prosecutor. And those things get bounced around, and eventually there will be a consensus. Right now, the consensus is that radar guns work. Okay, if you get nailed with a radar gun, you generally accept it because that's built up over time.
There are still ways you can challenge them if you pay enough money to your litigator who knows how. I don't know how.
Right.
Well, they're not.
But 99% of the time,
chances are, if you blew past the speed trap and they catch you for going 90, you probably were going faster than that anyway. They usually knock it down a little bit just to be a little bit nice. But, you know, each time I've gotten hit by a speed trap, yeah, they were right. I was speeding. And if I wanted to go argue it, I maybe could have made some leeway. But there's something to be said for, I was speeding. So even if I could prove that the speed trap, that the radar gun hadn't been, the one that I've heard, I don't know if it still works, that if you can challenge when the last time it been calibrated was. Mm-hmm. That was something that for a while worked, and that's almost into old wives' tales. But I've never challenged it because I was speeding. I broke the law, so there's a penalty involved.
From an enforcement standpoint, you're coming back home from Canada, and let's say you're just a horrible pirater, but you have everything in a
Yar.
Folder
Yar.
Called private client document. And you simply refuse to provide the password to them, what are they going to do, seize your laptop?
That is a giant can of worms.
That's why I use that example.
Thank you so much. Opportunities for computer geeks everywhere.
Yeah, as an attorney, I have an attorney-client privilege with my clients that I am actually not free to violate.
Right.
Judges, for some reason, being former attorneys, are very protective of that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's some muddled case law on whether the courts can force you to provide the password to an encrypted file. There's some that say they can, a lot that say, I think the majority say that you can't. But I think it's treated like spoliation. You may know this better than I do, Cara, that there's a case that I don't remember the exact details, but a guy had been tracked downloading child pornography, had his computer seized, large block of encrypted data, refused to provide the password, and the prosecutor said to the jury, look, here's what he got. You can infer from this that he's got a big block of encrypted child pornography, because it kind of hangs together.
Wouldn't the right to not incriminate yourself apply at that point?
Right, he didn't have to disclose the password, but the jury could infer.
The jury could infer what they wanted. You can't force him to disclose it any more than you can force him to say, yes, I downloaded kiddie porn.
Right.
Because you have a constitutional right not to.
Right, but the jury can't infer the fact that he's keeping a secret when they knew going in.
Well, they can also infer something from if the defendant doesn't choose to testify, or if the defendant doesn't choose to answer a question. You can't force him to answer, but the jury can make reasonable inferences. And I'm not, that's the constitutional part, I'm pretty sure, of how it works in trial. I'm not a trial lawyer.
Right.
Wouldn't that be a fairly straightforward application over to the encrypted stuff? You can't be forced to disclose incriminating information, but they can infer, gee, if it were his tax files, he'd have opened it up.
Right, but in the situation of attorney-client privilege, or you have trade secrets, you're a game programmer, and you have the next Halo, and you are not going to let anybody see this. You're J.K. Rowling, who had the manuscript to the last Harry Potter movie and did not go through security with it because she was not going to let the guard read it. and they finally called a supervisor letter through.
Nice.
But it's an interesting question when you have a legitimate reason for keeping a secret, but you also have the suspicion that you're keeping a secret for an illegitimate reason.
Right.
I suspect in that case the judge will, if I were the judge, I'd try to see if I could see it. It's called in camera, just the judge and the lawyer sees it, and then make a ruling based on that. But it, anything goes.
Good.
So I'm curious. I travel back and forth a lot from the United States to Manila. Manila being obviously a big part of the country. You can walk mm-hmm. on any street, you can pick up a DVD.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious because I also, one of the guys that I travel with is one of our engineers, and he happens to be from India, but he looks more Middle Eastern than he does Indian.
He has enough trouble getting to the airports already.
So every time we travel together, we both work for the same big multinational corporation. And it's a joke now because they're going to go, okay, I'm going to get to go to security, and you know they're going to. Yeah. And like clockwork, every time, of course, they do. And it's obvious, I mean, it's profiling, but they don't claim it.
We don't profile. What?
No,
what? No?
You know, they don't hear about it.
Yeah.
But the interesting question, and I'm concerned about as far as ACTA goes, is that what happens when you give the police that additional power? Oh, well, maybe he's pirating movies now.
Yeah.
So it's another step that they have to go and, you know, darn it, I don't think he's a terrorist, but maybe we can find an MP3 in his file. Maybe we can find a movie that he personally owned and have, you know, burned it in DivX or whatever, his laptop, obviously, don't watch that 23-hour flight.
Yeah.
But it also very much appears that it's also another tool, and I hate to say harassment, but that's what it boils down to, for phishing expeditions for law enforcement and or harassment for certain groups.
Well, the fishing expedition, let's see. There are corporations that have signed certain non-disclosure agreements that are advising the ACTA Treaty Board. They're advising. They're working with them. Like, I don't know, Google, eBay, Dell, Business Software Alliance, the movie industry has probably advised them greatly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, your rights are going to be infringed upon. One of the really bad things about the ACTA Treaty is it's going to cultivate, you know, just a culture of surveillance and suspicion everywhere you go. You know, where you're going to constantly be going, oh my God, what did I put? Did that guy really send me that file in my email? Am I going to get in trouble for that? Did I delete it? Oh God. And wait, did I delete it? It came through a network server. It's still traceable. I am so screwed.
$4,000 Dell laptop, and they go, hi, well, we think you have something on it, so we're going to impound your laptop to crush it. But at what point, is there any appeal process to this at all where I go, hey, you know, there wasn't anything on it, but we already crushed it, so we can't tell that you, you know, didn't actually have anything on it, you can get your $4,000 on it?
Not that I've seen.
Right.
I'm just going to be, you know, shelling out at random and crushing your laptop.
No. With respect to the United States law, again, recall that they can't do that without some reasonable cause. Since this has to work through our system in our country. Now, what they can do to you in Saudi Arabia, oh, golly knows. Yeah, they can take it now, and that's fine. But when you're talking about coming back into our country, which is the laws that we at least understand better, nothing in this treaty can trump your constitutional rights, and you do have rights against an unlawful or unreasonable search and seizure. Now, how do those work when the border guard takes your computer? You don't want to be the test case because being the test case sucks. But eventually, if this gets enacted and if it gets implemented, two huge steps from now, if this gets enacted in a way that has those things in it and then it's implemented by Congress into our statutes, and if the border authorities do start enforcing this, or if they target you, or if the motion picture people manage to pay for a nice squad of ACTA thugs to go enforce at the border somehow, you still cannot trump your constitutional rights against unreasonable search and seizure. And your computer is covered under your papers in effect. They can't just take it like that regularly. That doesn't mean in one isolated case they can't. Under our current criminal law, after they have the warrant or don't have the warrant and kick in your door and destroy your photography studio and then say, oh, whoops, we didn't find anything, you're still without remedy. There are supposed to be procedures in place to keep the abuses from happening. It doesn't always keep abuses from happening, but they can't just openly do that routinely. That would not be allowed under the Constitution. You won't be exempt against an individual abuse. it happens now under the criminal laws. The exclusionary rules, one of the stupidest rules ever, it's the best we got. There are a lot of things under the current criminal statutes that are, you know.
I mean, if we're supposed to be presumed innocent until proven guilty.
Not anymore.
That's changing.
It is. And I think in your example, if you get caught by U.S. border security coming in, you know, at customs, your computer will almost certainly not be not be destroyed until after trial because it's evidence, and spoliation is a bad thing.
And if they, the first one that they do that to, they will be slapped down and told, no, that's not how you're allowed to do it. So now, that doesn't mean you'll get your computer back tomorrow to use at work. You know, if they, it's 4 years later when the first summary judgment filing has been made, you may or may not be allowed to visit it. But, you know, but it won't be crushed within an hour of seizure.
Unfortunately, the Ninth Circuit has already ruled in favor of it. There's already case law in the books.
They can't possibly have made a decision based on a treaty that hasn't been implemented.
Nah, it's not necessarily based on the treaty. It's just the Ninth Circuit has made some rulings that support the ability to go in and take things off your computers. I'm sorry? I can. It'll take me a few minutes to look that back up, but yeah.
Well, let's take that question in the meantime and come right back to that while you're looking up.
So far, a lot of these examples you're using are about coming into the United States from someplace else.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's my understanding that the Insula cases talk about foreign nations where the Constitution doesn't apply, like Puerto Rico.
That's not a foreign country. That's a territory, and your constitutional rights apply in Puerto Rico.
It's an unincorporated territory. I refer you to Falls Act in Puerto Rico, where the guy said, I didn't get a jury trial, and the Supreme Court said, that's not part of the Constitution, doesn't apply there.
Well, you have to understand that the Constitution provides you will have a federal trial as a jury.
Right.
State law
right.
is totally different. So, for example, in Georgia, you can have a 6-person jury or a 12-person jury. Mm-hmm. In Texas, I believe you must have a 12-person jury regardless. And that doesn't matter. And in Puerto Rico, you may not have a jury. You may just have investigating judges. And it's state law. That's federalism.
Death penalty varies greatly from state to state.
My suggestion is read Balzac v. Puerto Rico and the Insular cases that specifically are talking about the fact that the Constitution does not follow the flag outside of where this place is. And Puerto Rico is still an unincorporated territory. They participate. They're a conquered nation. They still participate separately in the Olympics. It's a different and foreign place. Just look up the Insular cases and Balzac v. Puerto Rico in particular. But my understanding is these rights that we have don't apply out there, don't apply in these foreign nations. So
that's correct. You do not carry you do not get to wrap yourself in the Constitution after you leave this country.
Right. So the concept of talking about your rights being violated when you come back into this nation in that way doesn't make sense because you don't have any. And if you want some, you need to change the Constitution.
Well, changing the Constitution won't make England obey it.
No, I'm saying the Constitution doesn't apply to U.S. activity outside of our borders.
Constitution
That's
does
correct.
Not right because it's not the U.S.
Right,
but once you're back here, you are.
And customs is
it's the whole rendition concept. If you're in a black site, a foreign place somewhere, whatever happens there, if we did it, you can't be prosecuted there because there's no jurisdiction for the courts to hear it.
That's not entirely
That's
true because there is
true.
Tort liability.
Yeah.
But let's just
and there
go
are
over
exceptions
that.
Anyway. To that, which I vaguely remember, and you probably
Alien
know.
Tort Something Act.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the statute's called, but.
What's your point? I think you've lost me at some point.
The question I'm talking about, we keep talking about our rights are being violated in these examples where we're coming back into this nation from a foreign place.
Okay.
You don't have any rights when you do that.
U.S. agents cannot violate your rights regardless of where you are. So, for example, you can't be kidnapped. Oh, I'm going to step in this one. I'm saying it. You cannot be kidnapped by the FBI or by bounty hunters under U.S. statute if you're in a foreign country, say in Mexico. You know, Dog the Bounty Hunter.
So how does that assassination program work?
Oh, boy.
What I'm trying to tell you is, read the Insular
cases. United States citizens.
Yeah.
They didn't have constitutional rights.
No, they're specific individuals. And I know that's another issue. But there are specific people that have been identified as citizens of the United States that have been targeted.
If you assume that a United States citizen was identified as a United States citizen, and
citizen
then
United
the government,
States.
Well,
not the same
a citizen.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
And then the government, with that knowledge, chose to kill them without a good reason, you have a likely Fifth Amendment violation, but you have to meet every one of those check marks. And let's say it was a predator drone strike. How do you know that it was a Fifth Amendment violation? It's essentially a time of war type strike. So Fifth Amendment's out the window. You already have you already have essentially probable cause. You're in war. So, I mean, I think you're stretching that a little farther than it's intended to go.
And I think we've gone pretty far afield from the ACTA treaty.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Now, I have not seen any death squads in ACTA. I mean, your computer may be at risk, but I have not seen anything that involves CIA strikes or predator attacks against copyright violators. Okay. Yeah. So I think we've stretched a little beyond even the extremist approach to ACTA.
But Carr was looking at something for us.
The Ninth Amendment case that we're familiar with.
I'm going to first say that I downloaded this from Wikipedia, so copyright infringement. But having said that, I've disclosed it. I think I'm free to read from it. They state that, I'm sorry?
The terms of the Wikipedia license allow that.
I don't know.
The terms very explicitly encourage that.
Yeah, you're not violating the law, you're fine.
Okay, so in July of 2008, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security disclosed that its border search policies allowed U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents to conduct random searches of electronic devices for information concerning terrorism, narcotic smuggling, and other national security matters. Alien admissibility, contraband, including child pornography, monetary instruments, and information in violation of copyright or trademark laws, evidence of embargo violations, or other import-export control laws.
Now, you said that you were familiar with the case. Have you read the actual text of the case, or have you just skimmed Wikipedia?
Well, no, I've not sat down and read the actual case law on
this. Wikipedia is not reliable in their summaries of cases. Now, I'm completely unfamiliar with this, so I don't know, but I don't listen to Wikipedia's general rule because they don't hire lawyers to write their stuff.
They actually don't cite the case right here. I'm going to have to go back to the end of the document. However, at the end of this paragraph, they say, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has previously upheld the constitutionality of laptop searches without reasonable suspicion at border crossings. Not yet.
So for right now, for right now, your device is safe from physical harm. We'll get back with you next year.
Like in Ahmad's case, he certainly had it. Well, we're going to keep this. And of course, he's in the States. He's based in Atlanta like me, and he flies to California. And they go, okay, well, we're going to keep this. Well, he doesn't have his, I mean, he gets it back, but he's had his laptop kept for like 2 days before.
Gracious.
Where he flies on a Friday, and doesn't get it back till like, you know, Tuesday of the next week. Mm-hmm. And he gets a little Homeland Security little thing, you know, your device was checked by Homeland Security and sent back to him. You know, and it's not a big deal, but I could see where if you were giving a presentation on Monday, if you were an important business, you mm-hmm. know, and you had some PowerPoint presentation or whatever, I could see where that could cause you some financial or some business harm. And it's well, too bad, you know.
I think the rule for him, for anybody who's very concerned about getting tagged by Homeland Security, is redundancy.
Well, he's going to thumb drives.
Don't travel is the first rule. But but the mod chip actually was an interesting point. That was another thing in the treaty that I wanted to get to in our last 7 minutes. There's a provision there saying that circumvention of a technical protection measure, that you're liable for that.
That's also currently the law now.
But there is a fair, I think it got rid of the fair use exception for...
There's no fair use exception to the DMCA.
Let me phrase this again.
The Copyright Office got to review that, read, and I don't quite understand how the Copyright Office makes law, but
They don't.
They can do exceptions.
Yeah. Every 3 years, they review for and create a list of specific exceptions. And most recently, they made specific exceptions for modding for essentially jailbreaking.
Yeah. Jailbreaking iPhones.
The best
devices.
They made a number of new exceptions, including some that relate to fan fitting.
Okay. The best the Copyright Office can do is enact a regulation, which regulation is trumped by statute, which is trumped by the Constitution. So if this thing goes into effect and it has a prohibition against jailbreaking or whatever, then they don't care. It doesn't matter what the Copyright Office
says. Yes, if this were enacted into statute, then it would trump the Copyright Office's regulations. That's true. But like I said, the DMCA exists now, which keeps you from using anti-circumvention technology already.
Right.
Now, I know that most people...
That statute is the review by the Copyright Office every 3 years. That's
right.
Right. But it doesn't have the force of statute.
One thing thing that's interesting is
One thing that's interesting is the chilling effects of a treaty like this. Like in a war zone, you know you have a right to, or you've been told you need to go here and do this, and somebody else there with a gun who is supposedly on your side says, no, stop, and you don't, he kills you. You were right, but you're still dead.
Yeah. And when the guy with the gun tells you to do something, do it.
Yeah. Don't do like the guy in
the... Don't say, no, my constitutional rights allow me to walk past you. The judge may eventually decide that you were correct, and your heirs may be pleased, but you'll still be dead. Listen to the guy with the gun.
Yeah, don't do like the guy in the car in Hurt Locker. You know, that bad idea. Well, that has the same effect here. If I have to pay attention, and the world isn't necessarily a just place all the time, even though in theory it should be. Even though there's laws that say it should be just, it may not be. So I have to pay attention. And if that means, hey, I'm just not going to take a laptop with me, or I'll just stop traveling, it's going to have a chilling effect. It's going to affect things that they had never intended on affecting. Have you heard of anything that people, like the EFF works on that, they have chillingeffects.org, as a matter of fact, talks about those specifically for the DMCA. So the question is anybody giving any advice to the ACTA committee saying, hey, there's gonna be some chilling effects here, have you thought about this?
I think that the RIA and so forth are giving them advice and are saying chilling effect, yes.
Yeah, I think that the advice they're getting is aware of and not opposed to that chilling effect. I think that's an excellent point, though. When you have any kind of statute like this, a lot of people will adjust their behavior based not on the language of the statute, which is what I tend to talk about, but on the practical effect or on the concern about being that person who is the test case for the abuse under that statute. And that's a very reasonable thing. And when we're talking to this particular group, you guys are much more aware of the terms of this. I mean, most people are vaguely aware of copyright law, much less this potential treaty that might one day be finalized and then might one day get before the Senate and might one day after that be enacted into our statutory system. But so you are much more likely to be the people who are chilled by this law, who will change your behavior based on, I'm aware this law exists, I'm aware that it's not, you know, you may or may not be aware, it's not supposed to do these bad things. I have heard these bad things occur, therefore I'm going to protect myself in these 15 ways. And some of those chilling effects are very real and significant, especially amongst the high-end users who are more concerned about this.
But
that's very true.
But if you are...
spread also, because if I go tell 10 people, you don't want to do that. And if I go tell 10 people that you don't want to travel that way.
You know, think about that. You've probably already changed your choice of footwear when you go through security. I have some lace-up boots. Yeah, I don't wear those when I travel anymore. Let me tell you, I used to wear those through the airport because they were the heavy thing that I didn't want to carry in my suitcase. Especially now, they get charged per ounce and, you know, double charged if I have it to carry on. So, you know, it's a completely innocuous example, but it's the same sort of thing. I'm aware that the TSA is going to make me take off my damn shoes, so I don't wear the lace-up boots. And I have to figure out, so I usually don't take them now because Delta charges me more if they go in my suitcase. So, you know, I don't think that I have a constitutional right to lace up boots. Nevertheless, my behavior has changed. There's been an unintended chilling effect. I think that there'll be a lot more important ones that do follow from increased regulation like this. I think you're right.
But I do think that the corporations that have to interact with intellectual property, especially foreign corporations, are going to change their behavior because the U.S. has constitutional provision. You know, it's a written constitution. Mm-hmm. If you're traveling through the Philippines, and they embrace ACTA wholeheartedly, say everybody going to the Philippines is going to be complying with Philippines law because that's the more strict, that's the more troublesome, not the U.S. law, which is much less difficult to deal with.
We're talking about border provisions here because it's one of the, well, it was brought up, and because it's one of the specific provisions in here about border patrol and that sort of thing. These laws are going to be general. If this becomes law, it will be general application. It will change the U.S. law. So it's not just that you can, it's not just that it's illegal for you to carry the materials across the border. It's illegal for you to have them on your computer here. You're just more likely to get caught when you go through the border because that's where you're stopped and subject to scrutiny anyway. But no, these would be general application, not just border application.
So
Christy's hanging out, and I use her example, she's hanging out at Starbucks, she's wearing black clothes, maybe she's listening to some alternative music, and the cop stops her on her way home. Is this another tool? Well, you know, she might have, you know, a counterfeit DVD on her back.
If the officer has probable cause, and you haven't established it yet, if the officer had probable cause, if she's wearing a Pirate Bay t-shirt and carrying a big sign that says, I hate digital rights management, okay, we're getting there. But I don't think you're going to have stop and frisks, basically. You know.
There won't be copyright infringement stop and frisks. It can't possibly get that. Unless we cure all of the crime, that's not going to happen.
The element that the cops like the ones they don't have much work with versus the one they actually have to work with. And while it may not be the thing that's big, can I take your laptop and make your life inconvenient for a while? Hey, you got to come back and get it in a couple of months for harassment.
Can the arrest with it safe versus the arrest?
Again, with something like that, you're still protected by the same laws you are now. They cannot do that for copyright infringement any more than they can do it for kiddie porn now. The mere possession of kiddie porn on your computer is enough to get you in a world of hurt, and they can't just stop you at Starbucks and say, I'm taking this to go look for the porn on your computer right now. They won't be able to take it and say, I'm going to go look for that BitTorrent stuff on there. They won't be able to do it any more for that than they currently can for kiddie porn.
But if they're looking at your computer for another reason and find it,
then you're, yeah.
It's a lot of, yeah.
We had a question over here I wanted to get to because he was.
Oh, yeah. First of all, on the TSA checkpoints, I still wear my lace up tennis shoes and I take my own damn sweet time. I, you know, believe in putting a little bit of drag on the system wherever possible.
Yeah, but there's those of us waiting behind you trying to make it time.
Yeah, I know. Believe me, I know. But really, my question is just to make sure I understand correctly. Congress would have to approve this treaty. It requires Senate. A vote in both houses. Oh, just the Senate.
The Senate ratifies a treaty. First, the president signs it. If he signs it, then the Senate has to ratify it. Once the Senate ratifies it, assuming it's not a self-implementing treaty, which I don't think it will be based on the current versions of the treaty, then both houses of Congress will have to pass laws like they pass any law to enact the specific provisions of the treaty.
Oh, interesting. So it's three steps. President, Senate, then they have to actually enact the laws, draft the laws and enact them. Okay. So my question then for the panel is, are there any representatives or senators who are making an issue of opposing this that we should call in support?
There were two who wanted it released. There's a Democrat and an independent. I forgot who they were.
Okay, problematic issues here. There have been several FOIA requests filed for the specific language within the ACTA treaty, all of which, as I understand, have been denied. Again, this makes it very difficult for the general public to be aware of what is being enacted. Therefore, the legislative process is somewhat being squashed because you don't know, and you're supposed to be able to talk to your representative, and if you don't know...
But it's not yet a legislative process. It's currently a negotiation between the trade representative and foreign trade representative equivalents. It's not yet a legislative process.
But in fairness, the argument why the FOIA... Now you're making me do it. Well, the FOIA requests were not complied with was Homeland Security, which is a load of...
Yeah, that's the Obama administration saying that, by the way. You don't get to blame W for that.
It was W first, though.
Yeah, but now Obama's doing it, too.
Yeah.
Which the reason they said that, and I think it's crap, too. It's certainly not Homeland Security. They're saying that because it worked. The practical reason that they've wanted to keep these not open to all of the scrutinies because they're still at such a beginning process. I mean, if you look at the text of the treaty as it stands now, the negotiators still have not come anywhere close to agreement on the specific terms. And they handpicked the people they wanted at the table to come to an agreement, and they still can't come to an agreement. And if they opened themselves up to having to have the entire world in effect at that table, there'd be no chance of this moving forward. So that I'm not justifying what they're saying, but the trade representative is hoping to come to an agreement that they can then bring to the public and that they will then go through the legislative process, and there's no way they can ever come to an agreement if it has to start with a committee of the world. And this is done on damn near every international agreement. It's not just this one. Right or wrong, this is not specifically secretive.
To answer the question that was actually asked, and then we'll get to you.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
I don't think we know. Just Ross off our heads. I go to the EFF page, go to their ACTA page, and they did track who was supporting and pushing the Freedom of Information Act requests. So,
according to both Georgia senators, when they answer by emails, they are behind this. They think it's a great idea because it's going to protect the copyright holders.
Okay.
Is there anything in this about things that are stored in the cloud Google Docs and all that that's not on your computer, but you have an account that points there?
I think Google, that's an interesting question. The cloud's still kind of new as a an arena for legal battle to occur with. I think you could be liable if they could track it to you, and that depends on how cooperative Google ends up being. I think also Google, you know, just like YouTube has had to deal with the DMCA, Google's got this interesting position of how accommodating are they to this enforcement regime. Well, I mean, yeah, Google is just an easy example because they're so big.
In general, the way it probably, the law doesn't say yet because it's too new for us really to know. The way it will probably work out is the way it does anything. If you put it there, if it's yours, the way a judge would understand yours, and that has to do with how these guys convince him it means, you know, what they tell him it means, and he believes one of them. It, you know, whatever, was that yours? Did you put it there? Is it still yours? And it'll be in terms like that because that's the level the judges are going to follow it. Whoever wins that argument is going to be the answer to your question. Is it trackable enough that lawyers and judges feel like there's significant or substantial enough connection between you and that thing?
Lawyers and judges who got liberal arts degrees. I mean, it's not going to be technical.
Yeah. Understand that lawyers, and as a rule, suck at technology. It's kind of amusing that one of my niches in academia is actually some of these technical issues. Go ahead, try to engage me in a technical conversation. You will start laughing your ass off because I'm, you know, this far from Luddite, but I'm an expert. So it's so the judges, I mean, judges are worse. At least the litigators often adapt to the latest technology to the extent they can use it in a courtroom. Judges, yeah, they still can't work PowerPoint, never mind understand even what the cloud would be. They think they have to ask a weather expert. And that's the way that the law gets passed, is the litigators convince the judge of one side or the other. One of the reasons, and this is a diversion, but I'll get back, but it's relevant in this, one of the reasons that copyright law even applies to software is that one very clever litigator convinced a judge, I mean, it's in the code now, but one of the early cases that made it work was and caused Congress and all that shit to happen, Cantu and the whole nine yards, was a guy with a, then it was flip charts because they didn't even have the computer stuff yet because we were just inventing this shit, convinced a judge that it should apply because the machine readable code is just ones and zeros. And look, here's a display of that, here is what is on that disk, or those punch cards, as the case may have been at that time. And he showed the digital readout, the ones and zeros and ones and zeros and ones and zeros and ones and zeros. First time the judge had seen anything binary and said, oh, but application of copyright law, even a very unappealing and meaningless string of ones and zeros on paper is covered by copyright law there. That's easy to understand because he saw ones and zeros on a flip chart. And that's where it started. So that's how the answer to your question will ultimately be decided. By guys says, oh, ones and zeros on paper. That I understand. That question I can answer, and it often comes to a litigator giving the judge the question phrased in a way that the judge can now answer it.
Way in the back. Oh, okay.
Also in the back. I heard a rumor that patent law might be covered under this as well. Is there anything to suggest that's being talked about?
Yes, the word patent multiple times in it.
Okay, so it is. It's something you know now to be true. Okay.
Yes. Well, technically we're over, but if you want to keep asking questions,
can we go to? Okay.
Yeah. So we got 7 minutes. Let's have 7 good questions.
with no answers attached, because 1 minute.
Easy for us.
Is there going to be any fair use in this whatsoever? I don't mind buying the DVD. I have no problem with it.
Mm-hmm. The question is, going to be any fair use?
I have no problem buying the DVD, the song, whatever. But I don't want to tote all that stuff around, so I copy it to my laptop. I use it from that aspect.
I think fair use will survive. What exact form it will take, it'll change from what it is now by virtue of whatever enacting legislation happens.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that will answer some of these questions, because I really do not know, having read this, how it, you know, even if we assume that the worst versions of what's in here, because most sections in here have two or three different options. Assume the worst all the way through this treaty and then get it ratified and get it enacted somehow. I still don't know how it's going to be enforced. Are they really going to open your computer at the border on a routine level? I don't see how on a practical level that can happen unless we have what she was speaking of about the ACTA cops. Well, who's funding that? Where, you know, how is this going to happen? So I don't know at what point I can't imagine right now how a border guard or a policeman at Starbucks could look at my computer and tell if there's anything infringing on there. Right now, I don't know how they would do it. So I don't know how they would do it under ACTA, which adds a couple layers to it, and most of them are international layers, so it's not going to necessarily impact you right here at home, because already what they're talking about in here is illegal. And that's one thing to realize, is that a lot of things in here that upset folks, but, you know, I shouldn't get in trouble for having that BitTorrent file. Well, it's already illegal. Whether it should be or not, different panel. This is enacting a lot of that if it occurs, and yes, the enforcement may be harsher, and the law, and our laws may be ratcheted up to be more intense. That's absolutely a possibility from these things. I just honestly can't imagine how it's going to be enforced. Not that it won't be, but I don't know. And I don't know if you guys have a practical level to that, but that's going to impact whether you have to carry, you know, a permission note from David Bowie to have his DVD or to have his, you know, CD downloaded on your computer. I don't know.
I think that what's going to happen is it's going to be on a case-by-case basis, and it's going to be like Courtney was talking about with the first guy who got copyright on computer code. It's going to be how you can convince a judge, because, you know, ACTA may be enacted, the legislation may be enacted, it may say, and fair use is done away with. And then a lawyer's going to stand up and say, Your Honor, we have 650 cases here of fair use, so, and we got one statute that sort of says it sort of doesn't, and the judge is going to decide with fair use, but to what extent, and it's going to be very wiggly for 10 years.
I don't think anybody in here doubts that downloading a BitTorrent file for, say, whatever movie's out right now.
It's illegal.
Everybody in here knows that.
So if you go by
the DVD,
penalized, you broke the law. Don't do that. You won't get penalized.
If you go by the DVD or you go by the CD or you go buy whatever, and you just want to copy it to your laptop or you just want to put it on your server,
so you can watch it on the plane, you know, coming
back. So you can go get it when you want it. Do whatever you want.
That's legal. How do you convince the border guard that one's legal as opposed to the one
you're
in Pirate
Bay?
And I've got no idea.
And it's basically going to be whether the border guard likes you or not. That's day.
Now, but again, keep in mind, that's the case now. You are currently violating the law, if the policeman at Starbucks wanted to do that, they'd have no greater or fewer rights then as now, because they're still going to be restricted by our criminal laws.
Unfortunately, though, at that point in time, your computer, whatever, will have been destroyed already. Again, you are presumed guilty before your innocence. Sorry.
You're not getting it back. You want a plane?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. When you're going through the airport, and that's the case now. If they say, we think there's something illegal on your computer, you're already screwed.
We're not saying we should be able to break the law. We're saying that the enforcement of this can reach incredible extremes.
Right. I think that there's definitely a risk of that. I think that risk exists now under the current law.
Well, the thing is, are we justified in our paranoia? I think that's the underlying question.
Just because you're paranoid does not mean they're not out to get you.
And the evidence of that they do stupid things is when the TSA takes a mom and their 5-year-old off to the side because he has the same name as a 40-year-old some person on a no-fly list, and the TSA people are like, nope, your name's on the list, you can't fly. I'm 5, you know. You've been to Jamaica 6 times this year, and it's like, I'm 5, you know. When they do things like that, when we see those things happening, there's this sense of justifiable paranoia that they're going to abuse this.
Oh, I'm with you on that. Absolutely.
I'm going to be...
You can sit here and say they already do, you know, they already have the right to do that now, but, you know...
They do quite enough now.
Well, I'm going to be the country...
But, you know, 15 years ago, you know, who would have imagined that going to an airport would be the process that it is now? You know,
15 years ago, those things were illegal.
Well, and that was changed by terrorists, or by our late discovery of terrorism.
It was changed by an event.
In other airports, it was like
that
before.
It was changed by an event, and this is another event. I mean, you can't make the argument that, oh, how could it get any worse? Because
I try never to say those words, but we'll find out very shortly.
You're doing the reverse of that. You're saying it's already illegal now. Well, things were illegal 15 years ago that are routinely, you know, are routinely problematic now that weren't then.
Right.
Know, so So
no,
it can certainly
I think
get worse.
That the question is open one now. This will this can very meaningfully, in effect, give them another stick to beat you with. And the last thing you need to do is hand them another stick. I agree. I think that, but again, some of it is, you know, how is this going to affect, how do we defend ourselves? We don't know yet.
I'm aware of that.
And a lot of it's already illegal. And I don't know how they do it now.
Based on the evidence of behavior, I'd say it's going to be bad at least how they're going to react.
So. Yes. I think we can all agree on that.
Last question.
As far as enforcement, my thought would be it's going to be a lot of, sir, do you have anything on your computer? Will you show me? And most people will show them, just like drug people show them their drugs.
It's amazing how often that does work.
All right.
What's in your trunk? Oh, here you go. Oh, look, it's cocaine. Yeah.
One more comment that I wanted to get to. This really hadn't been discussed much, but aside from examination of our rights and everything, one of the themes that I see is in ACTA and what's going on generally is an exercise in cost shifting. The copyright industry has spent enormous amounts of money enforcing their rights, especially RIAA, and their strategy is shifting away from that, and they're shifting more toward putting the expense burden onto the ISPs and onto the government, which is public money. So they're trying to get us to take our money out of our pocket that we had to pay in taxes anyway and do their enforcement work for them.
That's actually a very valid point, I think. And God knows that the rights holders on that level are desperate because they're not doing well.
Yeah, it's a great point.
But I think that's right. If you start having federal enforcement of these things rather than individual enforcement of, wait, that's my movie that you have, if they can get the government to look on your computer for them, you're right. They're saving a world of money in litigation costs and enforcement costs of their own.
The way they would do the act of police is simple. They would raise the prices on your DVDs and your CDs. That's how they're going to pay for it.
No, they're going to raise the tax.
All right.
Yeah, when do we get our tax increase so that we can have our laptop checked?
There you go. Pay more to the government. It always suits you well.
Maybe next year we'll actually have an actual tax to work with, and so we'll see all that.
I think it's interesting that they want to defund the military, who are protecting us, for people who are actually shooting at us, to fund the ACTA police to protect us from people throwing MP3s. So
they might shoot at us. You never know.
Just so you're aware, there is a text that was released in April of 2010 for public use.
Yeah, and we've all got it.
Reading.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's available on the EFF website.
Yeah.
Let's go and plug them or at it. EFF.org.
Sorry, I don't have the...
Okay. Well, we've got people coming in for the next one, and so I need to go ahead and wrap it up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.